Hi folks, welcome to episode 44 of the Epochs of the Loadseaters. I am of course joined by Beau, and we are continuing our discussion on Napoleon, the infamous corporal, as it were. But we're going to be talking about his early life and how he rose to prominence, because in the previous episode we talked about the chaos of the French Revolution, and it is from this chaos that a ladder emerges that this little corporal, as they called him, wasn't it?
That he
was able to rise to prominence. But I'm not trying to underplay his genius or anything like that, because he clearly was.
A super quick word on that name, the little corporal.
Yeah.
It was originally a term of endearment from his own men.
Oh, really?
Yeah. In fact, we'll talk about it here, because it's right at the beginning of his career.
Right.
Where he was an artillery officer.
Yeah.
But even when once he gets promoted to a general or senior general, he's still sort of up the front directing artillery batteries.
Right.
And so his men called him the little corporal as a term of endearment.
Yeah.
Because it sounds a bit disparaging, doesn't it? Like it's something Wellington would say.
It's Caligula, isn't it?
It
comes from little boots.
Caligula. But Napoleon likes.
Yeah.
He seemed to like it. So,
well, it's a term of affection. Why wouldn't you?
Yeah, he's one of us.
Yeah, he's one of us. Yeah, he's got a nickname.
You know,
anyone who's got a nickname is part of the group.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
But just a quick thing. He wasn't actually that short, was he?
No, he wasn't particularly tall, but he wasn't tiny.
No, I recall seeing like a thing about it a while ago. And apparently he was 5'7" in modern measurements, but there's a difference in the British and the French measurements. And so to the British measurement, because it wasn't being adequately translated, in modern measurements, 5'7", I mean, that's shorter than average now, but in, 200 years ago, that's not that short at all. And the British were misrepresenting his height, basically. So he was coming across like a midget to them, but he wasn't actually that short. But anyway.
That, and in a lot of the satire, a lot of the cartoons of the day, he's always shown as small. You know, your enemies are small.
To diminish them.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway. Okay, well, so perhaps we should start at his early life. Because, well, just to say real quick, in 1789, the year of the revolution, of the tennis court oath and all that, Napoleon's 20 years old at that point.
I thought he was younger, actually.
I was listening to a historian saying that that's really important, you know, to be one of these great, great figures in history that tower over history, like Alexander or something. You've got to be lucky with when you were born.
Yeah.
Really. You have to be born at the right time.
Yeah.
Otherwise, the opportunities just won't. And anyway, to be young and ambitious and in the right place in 1789 is absolutely key.
Yeah.
So that's an important thing to mention. Mm. So should we just start with his sort of early life?
Yeah, let's go.
So he was born on Corsica, which when he was a very little boy was basically annexed by France. Mm. And the Corsicans are relatively proud. I think today they consider themselves more or less part of France, or more French than anything else. Mm. But also they're Corsican, they're their own thing, you know. And so anyway, this plays out quite a lot in Napoleon's early life. But so the thing was, he's a big part of a big family. That's not uncommon.
Minor aristocracy, weren't they?
Yes, absolutely that. His father was, aristocratic, but minorly so, and certainly not really had any money. They weren't sort of on the breadline, but they didn't have any real wealth to speak of. Because it was such a big family, Napoleon's one of eight. He's got seven siblings. And his mum actually was pregnant like 13 times. I suppose it's just the way things were a bit more back then. Before contraception or whatever. He's the second oldest, and just to cut ahead on that, he makes most of them kings and princes and dukes and archdukes around Europe at different points.
How convenient.
It'd be nice.
To be brilliant and I have a big family.
Yeah.
I'm very useful.
So like he'll make his older brothers, they're like the kings of Spain, kings of Naples, kings of Lombardy or Westphalia, etc.
Isn't there a deep irony? In the French Revolution, deposed the monarchs of Europe. And, oh, by the way, our leading light, our great emperor, is actually just going to make kings all over Europe as well. Isn't that deeply ironic? A massive contradiction there?
Yeah, no, huge. That's why I don't agree with the idea that the Napoleonic era is a continuation of the French Revolution.
Really?
Yeah, I don't buy it. I feel like there's a sharp difference, at least when Napoleon crowns himself as emperor in 1803. Certainly then, There's a break in my mind.
I can see where you're coming from, but you can't deny it's a product of the revolution.
Oh, yeah, sure. So but everything's a product of what came before.
Sure.
But it's not the same thing. Like, I was listening to something, in fact, Academic Agent, Academic Agent, Apostolic Majesty said to me that it was sort of a very direct continuation. It's the same thing. And I just don't agree with that.
Well, it's not the same. It's not the same paradigm, is it? Because obviously you can't have an emperor coming out of the Republic. That's the failure of the Republic when an emperor is produced.
Right. Yeah.
The same with the Romans. Same with the French. And so you are right. It is something different, but it is still an ancestral continuation of the circumstances.
Yeah. But, like, I mean, that's the argument you could say. It's like an Augustus-type figure. He's an emperor, but he's actually, it's like a Republican-style emperor. It's a Republican version of an emperor. Well, I just don't buy any of that. It's nonsense. He's an autocrat, and that's the end of it. The fundamental motivations for the French Revolution are gone by the time Napoleon's an emperor, in my opinion.
Yes, and the way it justifies itself is gone. As well. But I don't think all emperors are made the same. Alexander or Darius are not the same as Augustus or Napoleon. You know, I think the emperors who come out of a republic do have a sort of difference to them. But I mean, fundamentally, this isn't, you know, the anti-monarchical republican politics of the early French Revolution.
No, not at all.
And necessity has driven that out, right?
Yeah. So. It just seems, the very first revolutionaries...
would never have consented.
It was kind of the opposite of what they meant.
Yeah, well, absolutely. You know? An emperor of France who's going to put kings all over Europe, that's exactly what we signed up for. Obviously, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, anyway, back to his childhood. He said his mum was really important. He didn't particularly like his dad. In fact, he seemed to have resented his dad in some ways and not been... proud of what his dad achieved at all, but his mum, he absolutely loved and adored.
So he's a mummy's boy.
To some degree. He said she was a disciplinarian, though. He said she was like, she had the mind of a man, or she said he had the head of a man on a woman's body or something.
You can see this in his relationship with, it was Josephine and other women during his life. He's clearly got an interesting relationship with women. Right?
We'll get onto Josephine in a bit. He's sort of what she was an older lady.
And she kept him at an arm's length, didn't she?
Yeah, she wasn't attracted to him at all.
No, and she treats him quite badly, I think. You know, at least to begin with. And like, you know, for a man of his prestige, and he wasn't like a hideous guy or anything, he was a pretty normal looking guy. So it's like for a man of his prestige, you'd think he would have women flocking to him, and yet he chose that one, you know. So obviously there's something interesting and a bit Freudian going on, I would say.
Although she was a sort of a professional courtesan who was sleeping with all sorts of people more important than him at that point. But in the end, he's sort of quite out of order to her in the end. Mm. Tables get turned. But nonetheless, he loved his mum very much. And he said, there's a few lines where he said things like, everything I am, I owe to her.
Yeah.
All my genius for whatever that is, I owe to her.
Right, okay.
So she must have been, there's not a great deal written about her, not that I've read anyway, but she must have been one of those extremely formidable women that just won't take any crap from anyone ever.
the term we're looking for is matriarch.
Yeah, right.
I don't doubt.
Sort of endless reserves of energy
eight bloody kids, and loads of them are going to be boys as well. You're like, how many boys are there? Like seven or eight, you know, six, seven, something like that.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I think there's five or six of them.
Yeah. So you've got loads of boys. She must have cracked the whip a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. And this idea that you raise men that have got very strongly their own mind, their own personality, their own opinions, that can only be born out of somebody, a real leader. It doesn't have to be a man.
No, absolutely. It's leader of a household.
That's sort of an important relationship, which, you know, once he becomes an adult man, you sort of forget about, but it must have owed a lot to her.
I swear,
he said he did.
When I was reading about Napoleon, I was thinking a lot about his relationship with his mother when I was reading about his letters to Josephine.
Oh, really?
And the way he was being, like, I found it embarrassing reading about his early relationship with Josephine. I found it embarrassing for him. And I did wonder. That's all I'm saying. I did wonder.
Anyway. Okay, so when he's so his father is sort of, as we say, sort of very minor Corsican aristocracy, so not really that important at all. But he had some sort of station. So when Napoleon's about 9 years old, they move to Paris. So Corsica's been overtaken by France, and they move to Paris, and he gets sent to a sort of basically a boarding school, not a full military academy, but a military type boarding school. So that's a very delicate age when you're about 9 years old, isn't it? To be completely separated from your family and left to sink or swim in a military school.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it's quite harsh, really. Yeah. I mean,
and especially probably in this era, you know, things are rough. You know, the France is a tense place when Napoleon's 9 years old.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and I wouldn't have wanted that.
And he's an outsider.
Yes.
He's welcome. Yeah. He doesn't even speak French very well at all, or not at all. And then when he does, he's got a very strong Corsican accent. So he's like this rube, this provincial kid that no one's interested in. And
And he gets stick about his accent for his entire life, doesn't he? You know, and he's treated just like, and it's really condescending as well. Like, you know, like
how the French are quite arrogant about their language. I don't mind saying that.
Yeah. No, this is absolutely true to this day. But yeah, and you can see that this has like a profound effect on him. And the thing is, it goes against the ideals of the revolution entirely. You know, this is meant to be the rights of man, the brotherhood of man. This is meant to be the universal view. And yet you're a filthy Corsican peasant, basically.
Yeah, a country bumpkin.
Yeah, exactly. A provincial rube, as you say. You know?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's interesting that the challenges Napoleon, just social challenges Napoleon faces that he conquers as well.
Yeah, yeah. Although apparently he was sort of quiet and brooding and introspective, you know, not to the point where he couldn't really interact or succeed in life. But yeah, he was certainly an outsider, at least to begin with. And his father was, as you can imagine, sort of a very minor sort of periphery character in the sort of legal and royal dealings in Paris. And it was his dream, his father's dream, that he could get some of his sons into good schools. That was sort of the level they were at.
Yeah.
That it was a great aspiration to just try and get them into a decent school.
Sort of level I'm at.
He would dream that they could become something better than he ever would be, which is quite nice, you know, because some fathers are really resentful of their own kids and
some fathers
keep them
like
down,
Rousseau.
Don't they? Right, yeah.
Some fathers just put their children up for adoption and say, bye, not my problem.
Oh, yeah.
I've got a social contract to write. He's an absolute awful
Completely
man.
Abandoned his kids, didn't
totally.
He, Rousseau? Just
yeah,
wasn't
like five
interested.
Of them or something. He was terrible.
Yeah, didn't Marx do that as well?
Well, I've heard conflicting stories.
Or he got a maid up the duff and just didn't happen sort of thing.
Well, he probably did.
Something like that, anyway.
Anyway.
Just one quick
Napoleon's dad wasn't like that. That's nice.
Yeah, no, Napoleon's dad seemed to have... Napoleon talked about him, hardly ever talked about him. And when he did, said, I hold him in low regard because he didn't fight for Corsica hard enough. He just gave in to the French.
Oh, come on.
Yeah.
What's Corsica going to do against France?
Right, yeah. Good point, yeah.
Like, you know, be reasonable.
And isn't that the foundation of everything you are, Napoleon?
Well, there
is
that.
You got to go to Paris.
Yeah.
Like, what you...
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, without that, yeah.
Some people just resent their dads, don't they? Their dad can't do anything right. Or, you know, sometimes...
Yeah.
I think
no,
he's
that's
one
true.
Of them.
That's
true. Maybe Napoleon had a chip on his shoulder on some level. Don't know. But anyway.
Let's be fair. You probably don't do the things Napoleon did if you don't have something of a chip on your shoulder.
Yeah, he was burning with ambition. Yeah. Absolutely burning with ambition.
He's got something to prove. That.
Yeah.
I mean, I suppose if I had six brothers or whatever, or five brothers, and, you know, I was an outsider in the country in which I lived, I'd probably have something to prove too, to be honest.
One quick thing just to mention. It's been noted that, of course, Napoleon becomes the champion of France, the greatest warrior France possibly has ever had. But he's not French, he's Corsican.
Yes.
But so it's interesting because, for example, Hitler wasn't German, he was an Austrian.
Well,
Stalin wasn't Russian, he was Georgian.
The Austrians would call themselves Germans, I think.
Yeah, Germanic, but he wasn't German.
Well, no, he wasn't. I think they would call themselves Germans, ethnically German.
Oh, ethnically, right.
As in,
but he wasn't born within.
He wasn't born within the state of right. Germany. Right, that's yeah. true. He was born on the border of it, you know, with Austria. But I think, like, they would still call themselves Germans, definitely.
Okay. But like, I mean, the idea
I
that,
see where you're going, though.
The yeah. idea that Stalin as yeah, well Lenin, is not. Yeah. Yeah. They're. There's something about being an outsider can actually, in the right circumstances, turn you to be ultra.
Yeah.
That thing. And it, you know, Hitler becomes ultra Germanic.
I think
Napoleon becomes ultra French.
It gives you an ideological reason to adopt the mantle, right? Because in essence, it's not true. But if you think about it hard enough and you assert the ideology hard enough, it kind of is true. You know, you can at least represent that thing because you're upholding these structures that everyone recognizes. But in essence, it's not true.
Hmm.
And I think it gives you an interesting perspective on things as well. I think it gives you a different perspective on the thing that is hard to gain from the inside.
Mm. That's a fair point. He could see it from the other side on some level.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when he's about...
The pedagogy of the oppressed here. but I mean, they're not wrong when, you know, like being on the outside of a power structure does give you a different dimension on the power structure. The, you know, the critical race theorists are not wrong on that point, you know. So there are things that you learn being on the outside that can't really be learned from being on the inside. And I think that's probably why the outsiders end up, you know, using this to their advantage. But anyway, sorry, I don't mean to go off on
that. Yeah. No, I suppose one of the next big things is that, pardon me, when he's about 15, his father does finally secure him a place at a prestigious, or the most prestigious, military academy.
Ah.
For boys, for young officers. So the French equivalent of like Sandhurst or West Point or whatever. And so that's lucky. That's sort of, it's undeniable that if that hadn't have happened, the trajectory of Napoleon's life would have been very different because this place is, it's like, Napoleon said he gets treated like an aristocrat there. Like you're groomed to be a gentleman. It's almost like a finishing school rather than real sort of military stuff. It's more like how to be a gentleman, how to behave in polite society. It's a bit more like that. And it's like fantastically ornate buildings and the mess hall was like a banqueting hall and things. So Napoleon's getting used to here what it's like to be in the very, very upper echelons of French society in Paris, you know.
Yeah.
So even though he is still absolutely considered a provincial rube, at least he gets a taste of it. He knows what is expected to be a gentleman in the late 18th century.
It's kind of like a foreigner going to Eton, isn't it?
They'll come out with
a very plummy accent and a lot of important connections.
And
they'll never really be like, you know, of the place, but they're still going to have a deep connection to it in a way.
Yeah.
You know? And this is, you know, the embedded into the society. But yeah, no, like, and this is not like an uncommon thing, is it? Like these sort of, you know, young, like lower aristocratic men going into the military and military academies is totally common, you know, because everyone in this era has huge families all across Europe. And so there's like a huge class of young men who are basically bred to the military because what else are you going to do with your life?
Mm.
You know, we need to get rid of a lot of these excess sons, basically, you know, and the British Empire was built on this in many ways, you know.
It's quite often in the medieval period or later, sort of the early modern period, the oldest son, assuming you've got a gaggle of sons, the oldest one will inherit.
Yeah.
And then the next one maybe will be groomed for in the church.
Yeah.
And the rest go in the army.
Yeah, because I mean you've got to do something.
Very sort of vague about things, but that's... But
it's not an uncommon trajectory, is what we're saying, you know. And so Napoleon's following a fairly, you know, well-trodden life path.
Yeah, and so he's trained as an artilleryman, because that's sort of his famous thing. Is sort of,
oh, yes.
You know, moving guns around. His teachers and his tutors and things said, he was pretty kind of quiet and introverted, but sort of super focused and serious and ambitious. Even then, they said, like, he's got the makings of what's required to be a good officer, like a junior officer. But he didn't exactly stand out. No one said, oh, he's like this shining bright personality that everyone could see from the earliest days was destined for greatness. Not that. But a sort of quality officer, junior officer.
Yeah, and I wonder how much of this is down to his outsider status as well. So I can imagine that, you know, in these military academies, there are kind of like native French Chads who they would be like, oh yeah, you know, Jean-Jacques over there, who's going to be, you know, he's the epitome of a French officer. And he's kind of enjoying a kind of privilege that Napoleon doesn't have access to. And so Napoleon essentially has to bide his time and, you know, become introverted and, you know, but as you say, like I'm, you know, intense is a good word. You know, I can see it, you know.
Loads of people say that. Josephine said that about him. Like, I don't like him. He's too intense. It's like, it's weird. Like, you can't even, lots of people said it's difficult even to hold his gaze and things. Like, he's so, brooding comes up a lot. Mm. People say he's sort of got a brooding character, but, okay, so he passes out of that academy as a sort of a junior officer. One of the main things he does before he sort of really enters the stage of history is that he goes back to Corsica.
Mm.
And there was sort of the leader on Corsica was a guy called Pascal Paoli, sort of basically the political leader on Corsica. Mm-hmm. And Napoleon had always looked up to him. He's a bit of a hero of Napoleon's.
Hmm.
Napoleon thinks, you know, I'll go back to, this is his thinking, I'll go back to Corsica. And I'm like this bright young officer. I'm now like a lieutenant in the cavalry, artillery. And I'll go there and I'll work for him, be under him, work my way up through the echelons of like Corsican society.
Mm-hmm.
And that was sort of his plan for life.
A fairly reasonable plan.
Yeah. But he gets down there and is sort of really, really heartbroken to find that Paoli doesn't like him at all. Doesn't trust him, doesn't like him. It's like, who's this young upstart, this kid?
Yeah.
Paoli said something like, he's just a big blustering boy.
Right.
Because he's still very young. He's not even 20 by that point.
Yeah.
And their politics were very different by this point. Right. By the time Napoleon comes back to Corsica, he is fully French.
Right.
In his own mind, at least.
Yeah.
Corsica, it's correct that Corsica should be French.
Hmm.
That's not how Paoli thought about things. Although he bent the knee, he was still sort of very, staunchly Corsican.
Hmm.
And so their minds, their sort of political views were opposing each other.
Right.
So anyway, just to cut some of these stories short, Napoleon ends up setting up his own political faction.
Of course he does.
Yeah, of course he does, in Corsica.
Yeah.
And after a bit of back and forth, he's beaten and ousted by Paoli and his faction.
Right, okay.
And he has to flee with his whole family into the hills for their lives, more or less.
Yeah.
And in the end, flee entirely from Corsica entirely and go back to mainland France.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.